Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren. And on today's episode, we have Jane Quick, who's taking over the family business of Quick's Cheddar, a premier cloth-bound cheddar producer based in Exeter, Devon, England. Jane, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is kind of one of my favorite cheeses of all time. I'll just say it like that. It's just, I think it's one of those magical, traditional, amazing cheeses that exist in the world. And I feel so lucky to have you on here to kind of cover and tell us about, first of all, I think we should even just clarify, because when I used to work at the counter, what is the proper way to say your last name? And because I've heard people pronounce the E, and it's not. So how can you, to the listeners, explain, you know, just a quick who you are and the name of the cheese and, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Absolutely. So the name is Quick. So the E is very much silent. Perhaps that's, I don't know, maybe that's a bit pretentious just to add an E on the end of your name.
No, it's
silent. But yeah, it's totally just a silent E that you can imagine is just not even there. And that's how you pronounce it. And then the cheese is Quick's traditional cheddar. And it's kind of Quick's, like, because it is the cheddar that belongs to the Quick's.
No, we should be clear. This is a family business. The history, I saw an Instagram post for, I think, Women's International Day that went back, I must have been 4 or 5 generations of a lineage. Can you talk to that just a little bit? Because I feel like this is, I mean, I think you had no choice. You had to go into cheese. Like, this is, you know, what is the family background? In relation here?
Yeah, so I guess without going back too far, because in those pictures, and I'm going to really show up my lack of knowledge of the names of my ancestors here, but there was a portrait of a lady who was very wealthy, and she was at some point in my, you know, came into my family, married into the Quick estate, and she, I think the sale of her library on her death paid for some really enormous, like, infrastructure that I think we still have today. And if you go into the church, but the kind of local church in our village, she's commissioned all of these very grand plaques, which are quite hilarious. Well, not hilarious. I don't know if you would say it's hilarious or not. But for me, being there, it's kind of a bit odd, having lived in other places in the world and being very much anonymous, and then coming back to this village church where all of my ancestors have these very ostentatious plaques all over the place. And so that's her. And she was obviously an important member of the family who had kind of funded the progression of the business a very long time ago. And my mother would be able to give me an exact date.
We should also mention, so your mother is Mary Quick, and so was it always cheese, or did Mary bring it to cheese, or was it cheese before Mary, actually?
So it was cheese before Mary, and it was, so during the war with rationing, a lot of, obviously, and lots of people know all about this, the milk was centralized to make kind of like really efficient block government cheese. And Then after the war, so and maybe if we rewind even before the war, my grandfather remembers his grandfather trying to sell milk from the dairy farm that we've had here since 1540, and being turned away. And of course, this was before refrigeration. So if you get turned away trying to sell your milk, it's really game over for selling that milk on that day. And so he made the decision as probably something like a 10-year-old guy, just I don't want to be at the mercy of somebody else, and I want to make something that people really love and they definitely want to buy. And then he went away, fought in the war, and then he came back and he became quite involved in politics, actually, to do with how farmers interact with environmentalists. And he was very sort of instrumental in having the environmentalists speak to the farmers under what they call Chatham House rules. So it wasn't a public forum, it was in private. And so that they could have a really good chat and work things out, and because things had got quite heated, I think. But all the while, obviously, he'd still had this intention to create this cheese business. And meanwhile, my grandmother had gone to, so his wife had gone to art school in London. She did a degree in fine art. And her professor had told her, a degree in fine art will really give you the tools you need to do anything you want. And she thought, brilliant, I can set up a cheese business and a cheese dairy. And so they, so she very much sort of orchestrated and set up the cheese dairy as it is today. And they sold their manor house in the center of the village to fund that project, and moved just outside of the village. And to make sure that she had got the recipe right as it would have been, before in this area, she interviewed, there were people making cheese in their kitchens in the village. And she interviewed the old ladies in the village. Who were making cheese in their farmhouses. And she used that recipe and stories about very much word of mouth recipes to develop the cheese. I mean, pretty much how it is today. And then I suppose just on the topic of recipes, we have worked with, we've worked with some really kind of capable dairy experts through the years, like Val Bynes, who has helped us to improve our consistency and the deliberateness about how we achieve the flavor of our cheese and our provenance.
And I think we should explain to the listeners. So I understand that like Quick's cloth bound cheddar is it the premier specialty of your portfolio? Are there other cheeses that you guys are also producing currently? What's available through Quick's cheese?
Yeah. So that's really the flagship cheese is the cheddar. We also, and we do different flavor profiles of the cheddar and different ages that we can talk about in a second. We also smoke the cheese. So half of our farm is woodland, and we use some of those trees to smoke, to oak smoke some of our cheddar. We also produce an elderflower cheddar, which is kind of a fun addition to the latest addition to our product list, and we do that because elderflower grows so abundantly in this area that it felt consistent with creating a product that's of this region. We also make territorial cheeses, which we call Double Devonshire and Devonshire Red, which are our take on a Double Gloucester and a Red Leicester. But we didn't feel like we should use the places because it's made in Devonshire, not Leicester or Gloucester. So we use those names. And then we have a goat's milk, hard cheese. And it's made in a very similar way to the way we make the cheddar. And so lots of people call it a goat's a goat's cheddar, and I almost never correct them because it is, it feels petty. And and although, you know, we, I suppose, you know, coming from cheddar country, it's we have very specific, strict definitions of what we would call cheddar. But actually, it's, you know, if somebody said, oh yeah, your goat's cheddar is great, I would say thank you. Not, well, actually, I think you'll find it's a hard goat's cheese. So yeah.
I thank you for not being petty to those poor people who don't know the difference. I you know, it's something I've only had on this show before. Shout out to Nick Bain. So honestly, my knowledge of United Kingdom English cheeses, it could be greatly improved. So, you know, having you on this episode to talk about everything related to your, you know, production and so forth is like, it's going to be enlightening for some people, and they're going to be like, wait, what is that? Well, I had no idea, because I think we know so little still about what's going on. And it's been, I know you have this tremendous history. So, if you could, I would love to know, could you talk about the process of making a cloth bound cheddar, like in the easiest one-on-one way? Hopefully it's not too intense, but, I think the listeners who, the cheesemongers out there would probably love to talk about this a little bit, you know, some points when they're selling your cheese, you know, because it's such an interesting process.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'll talk about it from what we do and where there might be points of distinction compared to what we do as to what other people do. I might point it out or I might forget. So bear with me. So we have obviously the milk from our own cows. So we milk the cows. We milk them twice a day, and then we collect the milk. And we collect it in a raw milk tank, and then we pasteurize the milk. Not everybody does. So, and that's, I suppose, a point of distinction. Some people don't pasteurize the milk. We then take the milk and we make cheese from it straight away. So we don't actually cool the milk down from pasteurization. So it isn't technically pasteurized in the same way that drinking milk would be pasteurized, but it's taken straight from the pasteurizer, straight into the vat, ready for cheese making. And the vat is has a steam jacket around it. And what that enables us to do is control the temperature of the milk and then the junket and then the curds and whey as the make progresses. So we've got this vat full of milk, and we add our starter cultures, so our bacterial cultures. And we're using heritage starter cultures that were collected from dairies around the Southwest in the 1970s. And what's cool about these cultures is there's all kinds of bacteria, like a really broad range of bacteria, and quite a lot of variation. And that matters for later in the process, or right from when we add the bacteria all the way through to when we mill the curd and beyond, because the having that really rich biodiversity of bacteria means that we have lots of activity with the protein and the sugar being converted into acid that is variable. And that really impacts the acidity development during the make and the final flavor that we have right through the whole maturation up to 2 years. And so we've added the bacteria. So we've got the milk, we've added the bacteria, and we're keeping the milk at this point, you know, nice and warm, around 30-ish more degrees, and then the bacteria is busy eating all the sugar and making turning it to lactic acid, and that acid is obviously really important for the flavor of the cheese, but also very, very important for the safety of the cheese, because it means that later, you know, as the cheese is maturing, it doesn't support the growth of pathogens, so it doesn't, nothing that will make people sick. And so we are then, I suppose the final really useful thing about the acid is that it creates a really optimum acidity environment for rennet, our enzyme, to coagulate the milk and to turn the milk from just a sort of free-flowing liquid into something that's much more solid. So our junket, what we call our junket, which is where the curd has set or the milk has set. And then so we've added the rennet and the curd is set, and we check that the curd has set, because sometimes it doesn't set in the way that we'd like it to. So we'd need to check, and we do that by sliding our hand into the curd diagonally and pulling up, and it should give you a clean break. So the curd just breaks in a sort of as you pull up with your hand. And we know at that point it's ready to be cut and heated. So we cut the curd using the sort of blades that come around, and that produces cubes of curd that we heat up very slowly, or nice and slowly. And that the action of the heat is useful because it excludes more moisture. So we get the curd being more solid and curdy and shrinking down into a firmer set. And then we get the whey being excluded. And at that point, when we're done with that bit, we pitch the curd down into the cooling table. And so what we mean by that is we take a pipe, we fill it to the vat, and we use the handy action of gravity to bring all the curds and whey down. And we drain the whey and we make butter from the whey. We make a very nice whey butter.
That's how you do that. Interesting.
Yeah. So we separate and churn the whey into butter, which is nice. It's a nice byproduct, thing to do with the byproduct of cheese making. And then we've got these sort of flecks of curd left, and we're reaching in. You imagine these long cooling tables. We're reaching in. Cheesemaker on each side, reaching into the center and piling the curd up, heaping it up in a long line on either side of the cooler. And so as we're doing that, the curd is sticking together. And then we cut the curd into blocks and we turn it over, and we do that by hand. And every time we turn the curd, we're checking the acidity, and we do that by taking some whey from inside the curd, and we do a titration. And the cheesemakers do that every single time they turn the curd, because they need to really keep an eye on the acidity. It's not running away with us and making too sharp a cheese, but also it's not what we call a slow vat, which is where the acidity isn't developing fast enough. And that can be for really serious reasons, like your starter culture is being killed off by bacteriophage virus, which is not unsafe for people, but is really annoying because you can't, then your starter culture is no good for anything if that happens. And that hasn't happened to us for a very, very, very long time, touch wood, because there are ways to manage it. And so then we're turning the curd over and over until it goes from it's all sticking together, and we stack it on top of itself to under its own weight and keep the heat in so that it's pushing, excluding out more and more whey, and also that the protein is sort of stretching, and it goes from being flecks of, looking like kind of like peas or rice kind of size to being like cooked chicken breast, kind of that kind of consistency. And then we take these slabs of curd and put it into a chip mill, so we're literally milling the curd and then adding the sea salt into the curd. We use Cornish sea salt because we found it has a very delicious flavor, and it feels, it's from the coast close by to where we are. And what that means, though, is because it's sea salt, it comes in really big pieces. And so we really have to fork it in. You have to go, and it's very hard work moving, forking. But what's really good is that because we have to do that to make sure the salt is properly dissolved and is included evenly in the curd, it really does make us make sure that we do it properly and that we don't end up with, so if you don't do your salt mixing well or quick enough, then you can get salt spotting and all kinds of problems. So it's really important to do that. And in a way, having bigger salt crystals makes us more diligent, I would say. Although maybe some of the cheesemakers in there doing that day in, day out may not share my positive sentiment. But there we go. That's how we do it. And so then we take the chips of curd, we push it into these stainless steel molds. And these molds, so we're putting 27 or 28 kilos of curd into a 15 kilo. Oh, sorry, this is not helpful to say in kilos.
No, it's fine. It's 50. It's really like 55, 65 pounds is what you're saying.
Yeah. So like say 60 pounds of curd, and then you've got, say, what would it be? Another, at least half of that again, so another 30 pounds. So 90 pounds, 90 to 100 pounds worth of carrying and you know, switching up to do. And so we then put that into our press, and that's pressed under 90 PSI. So like really quite a lot of pressure, and that helps us get the whey, more whey out. And so we're draining, there we are, draining the whey over a day. And then we bump out the cheese and we've got the cloth around it, the really coarse cloth around it. And then we bump it out and we press, put another cloth on it, press it again. And then on the last day, we bump it out and we put a very thin cloth, a very fine cloth on the outside of the cheese. And we've got put the lard on the outside of the, or dip the cloth in lard. And so it sticks to the outside of the cheese. And then we put the cheese in the store. And where it stays being turned and taken care of for up to 2 years.
Oh, wow. Oh, so that's another thing I wasn't sure of. Yeah, 2 years. Okay. Wow. So you really, that's a lot of planning to go for if you're, when you're trying to sell cheese, you're like, how much cheese do I need to, how much cheese can you make? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So how much cheese will people want in 2 years' time? And we have the capacity to make a lot more cheese than we're currently making. So if really? Anybody, so if anybody wants
that's unusual. Sometimes I feel like you don't have enough milk. It's like, that's good to know. And actually, regarding the milk, cause I was researching, thank you for that explanation, by the way, there's so many things in there that I didn't actually know myself. So, thank you for that. That was awesome. I was reading on your website about the breeds of cow that you, is this still true that you have several different varieties of cow on your, yeah? Wow. Okay. Like it said, correct my enunciation if you want. It's Montbéliard, Scandinavian Red, Brown Swiss, Kiwi Holstein, Frisian, Kiwi Frisian, and Jersey.
That's right.
Wow. Amazing. What is it like to work with that many breeds? Is it like helpful or is it harder to work with that, like a mix like that? Do you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm not with the cows. I used to spend summers milking cows when I was studying. So a lot of my firsthand experience with the cows comes from that, and perhaps not as much more recently. But the different cows have different personalities. It's also should be said that it's a genetic mix. So it isn't that like there are 10% pure Montbéliard and 33% pure Scandinavian Red. It's there, you know, there will be, if you, and what's really fun is coming and looking at our herd, which I'd recommend people to come and do if they'd like to. You look at them and you go, oh yeah, like that cow's got the face of a, you know, Scandinavian Red, but the body of a Montbéliard kind of thing. What it means is there's some really beautiful colors and patterns. But it also has to be said they have different personalities. And so the Montbéliards have a bit of a reputation for being pretty sassy in the milking parlor, especially to begin with, and their first, they haven't have been, you know, they've maybe just had their first calf and they're coming into the milking parlor for the first time. And it takes some getting used to anyway. But I think the Montbéliards definitely have a bit of a reputation of being on the sassier side. When my grandfather was more involved in the business, he had this beautiful, pure Holstein herd. And it was great, you know, really productive dairy, you know, cows, really kind of pedigree that he was very proud of. And my mum came back to the family business and was like, I really want to make sure that we're grazing on grass for the most possible time and that we've got a really healthy, happy cow. And so she introduced, I suppose, genetic diversity into the breed that's taken generations and generations to kind of come to this Quicks cow. That's the mix of all of those breeds that you mentioned. But what she observed when she did that was that when it rained, the Holsteins would go look pretty miserable, stand under the the hedge, and these hybrid cows with all this hybrid vigor, they would just be loving life in the middle of the field, feeding all along. So I think I joke that we breed the cows for their personalities, which is which is a joke, but it's also somewhat true. But the other thing I suppose about the breeding is that obviously what we're looking for is this really great milk to make our cheese with. And that comes from the types of protein and the types of fat that exist in the milk of different breeds of cows. So different breeds will give slightly different types of proteins and types of fats. And the ratio also is really important. And by having a hybrid herd, you do just get like really healthy hooves and healthy udders, which is obviously something that we care about.
Yeah, wow. I never thought about that before. I guess I usually, when I've interviewed other cheese producers, they're generally, I think, just one kind of cow. So that's pretty interesting. All right, we're going to talk about sustainability and all the other cool things that go with Quicks in just a second. We're going to take a quick break. Hey, everyone, you're listening to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren, and we will be right back. Hey everyone, welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren. I'm here with Jane Quick of Quick's Cheese, and we're talking about all things cheddar, England, UK, breeding, sustainability, all the good stuff. But on the other side of the pond, which actually, Jane, I really am so excited that you can join us from Devon. Like, that's pretty cool. Are you in Devon right now? I hope you are.
I am. No, I totally am. I'm sitting in darkest mid-Devon in the middle of the countryside. I'm just happy that there's enough internet signal for us to be able to chat.
Oh my God. Yes. Totally a thing that happens for us on Cutting the Curd often. I want to talk about next your commitment to sustainability, because when I saw you at the Salon du Fromage, I think one of the things I felt like you were most excited about was, the way you guys are implementing eco-friendly practices and going to traditional practices that were maybe ruled out but have come back. So, I'd love for you to just talk a little about that and explain what's going on over at Quicks for eco-friendly stuff.
Sure. So I think I'm always really scared of greenwashing. So I always want to just to put that out there to begin with, that I really want to just talk about like factually what we're doing. And so I was really inspired by learning about, my mum often teaches me about the history of our family and the business. And during the late 1800s, when grain started to be exported from the Americas to Europe, the price of of crops, particularly wheat, fell through the ground. And what my family decided to do at that point was to grow oak trees, which to me now in this kind of modern world seems, you know, both nuts and amazing, because oak trees take so long to grow, to become fully grown, that they would be have been making a business decision at that point for the estate that would never come to fruition in their lifetimes, which is just like such amazing forward planning and really cool. So, and half of our farm is still woodland.
But
I feel like, you know, that long looking into the longer term and thinking about what will this, if we make the, you know, what are the decisions now going to mean for the farm and this area in 100 years time or in 200 years time or beyond. And I think that's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And I'm, to be completely honest with you, like, I'm not 100% there yet in understanding. And part of coming back to my family business has been a really steep learning curve in the intricacies of farming and grassland management. And so some of the things that we're really focused on is our soil organic matter and soil structure. And this isn't something that you can change overnight. And it can be incredibly frustrating because you're, you know, you're putting in, you know, this, you know, you're using herbal lays and mixed swards. So you're mixing, not just having grass in your fields, but also these really deep rooting, deep rooted herbs and other broadleaf plants that help with the biodiversity within your fields, which helps with insects and birds, but also and mammals, but also you are helping to improve the soil structure because the roots get down into the soil and help to create that. And so that's something we're looking at, and also looking at how we replenish the nitrogen into the soil, and that's, you know, the handy plants like legumes and clover that everyone's got really interested in, because actually if you are really effective at making sure that you've got those kind of plants doing the work for you, then you don't need to be adding so much or anything to your soil if you're really good at it. And so those are the things about, I suppose, the grassland side of things. And the grassland is so important for management. It's so important because that's the food for our cows. And we've had some really challenging weather in the UK, as I'm sure we, you know, people have been having all over the world, with very wet winters and sometimes very wet summers even, and then very dry summers, which makes it incredibly difficult to manage the grass, which likes the sort of typical weather patterns of England, which is rain nearly every day and be 15 degrees C, and you can translate that for me, please, into Fahrenheit.
No, you know what's funny? Go to the degree stuff, I kind of fail. I'm only going right. to... So I'm sorry to say that.
So it's like, I guess the joke is that it's like a it's like mild weather plus or minus 10 degrees, also mild weather for like 100% of the year. So that's you know, our climate is very mild and it's very consistent. And so some of these more extreme, you know, weather patterns are really, you know, really causing us to think very carefully about how we manage all of that. And then where we have to, you know, where we have to grow some additional food to make sure that we can bring our cows in if we need to when it's very wet in the wintertime, so their hooves aren't chewing up the fields and making them into a mud bath.
Right.
So then what we want to do is look at what can we grow together to create really good food mixes, but also protect the soil. So things like growing beans together by cropping with oats. It's really cool because you could, the beans fix nitrogen in the soil at just the right moment in their growth cycle so that the oats can assimilate it and put the nitrogen into protein in the grain to make a really nutritious grain for the cow's teat. And so that's the sort of, that's the plant element of the sustainability that we're looking at. Another, and there are lots of techniques and other things we're looking at. And but I think the other things I suppose that we do is we've just got a lot of solar panels up. So we're looking to generate as much of our own electricity as possible. And this morning, actually, we just had a meeting with somebody who's invented this very nifty contraption to be able to capture methane produced by the slurry from the cows and then turn it into fuel that we could then use in our vehicles.
Oh, wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. So cow fart power tractors is what we're going for.
I mean, isn't that what we're all working towards? I feel like it is.
That's the utopia. And it all feels like it's coming at us quite fast, or coming at me at least, because I'm fairly new back to everything. And I'm just trying to make sure that we're doing the right thing and also keeping everything running, smoothly and in a way that makes sense for us.
Absolutely. No, Jane, this is amazing to hear what's going on now for you. And congrats on everything. I'm looking forward to see how your influence is on Quix. And I think everyone's just happy to eat more of your cloth-bound cheddar and to see it for more years. So thank you for all of that. I just want to say thank you for coming on the show today. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about, but I feel like we got a good chunk in there. But I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Cara. Really appreciate it.
I just want to tell the listeners, hey guys, if you want to listen, if you want to follow Quix Cheese, please follow them at Quix with the E. So Quix and then cheese. And then you can follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Cara Warren. And please listen and subscribe to Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to your podcast. Also, one more note for you guys. American Cheese Society is happening this July. So we want to encourage people to apply for the scholarships. If you want to go to the conference, it's all made possible by the American Cheese Education Foundation. So applications are open now and they close by April 2nd. So please go do it, get to it, write your little answers to those questions, and hopefully we see you in Buffalo. The application is on cheesesociety.org/scholarships. Get to it. All right, thanks everyone, and eat more cheese.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.